Hey, welcome to a very, very special edition of the Life 2.0 podcast celebrating 230 years of the United States Coast Guard. Let's get to it.
From Aztec shore to Arctic zone to Europe and Far East, the flag is carried by our ships in times of war and peace. And never have we struck it yet in spite of foeman's might, who cheered our crews and cheered again for showing how to fight. So here's the Coast Guard marching song. We sing on land or sea, through surf and storm and howling gale, high shall our purpose be. Semper Paratus is our guide, our fame and glory too, to fight, to save or fight and die. Aye, Coast Guard, we are for you.
So hear the Coast Guard marching song. We sing on land or sea, through surf and storm and howling gale, I shall our purpose be. Semper Paratus is our guide, our fame, our glory too. To fight, to save or fight and die, my Coast Guard, we are for you.
I got to tell you, full disclosure, I got a little bit, some chill bumps on my arms and legs when I said the United States Coast Guard for one big reason. I was in the Coast Guard from 1980 to 1984, and then I did 2 years in reserves, and my memories from that time are solid gold. And the mission of the United States Coast Guard has always been to serve and protect this country. And matter of fact, I'm going to read this right off Wiki because I couldn't write it any better. So whoever wrote this Coast Guard page, it was fantastic. Coast Guard's a maritime military multi-mission service unique among the U.S. military branches for having a maritime law enforcement mission with jurisdiction in both domestic and international waters and a federal regulatory agency mission as part of our duties. It operates under the United States Department of Homeland Security during peacetime and can be transferred to the U.S. Department of the Navy by the U.S. President at any time or by the Congress during times of war. Congressional authority transfers happened twice, 1917 in World War I and in 1941 during World War II. Some of the most incredible acts of heroism, matter of fact, were on Omaha Beach by the Coast Guard, who delivered all the Marines and the infantry to it and took some heavy casualties. Created by the U.S. Congress on August 4th, 1790, at the request of Alexander Hamilton as the Revenue Marine, it is the oldest continuous seagoing service of the United States. As Secretary of Treasury, Hamilton headed up the Revenue Marine, whose original purpose was collecting customs duties at U.S. seaports. By the 1860s, the service was known as the U.S. Revenue Cutter Service, and the term Revenue Marine gradually fell into disuse. The modern Coast Guard was formed by a merger of the United States Revenue Cutter Service and the U.S. Life Saving Service on January 28th of 1915 under the U.S. Department of the Treasury. And then in 1939, the U.S. Lighthouse Service was also merged with the Coast Guard. As one of the country's six armed services, the Coast Guard has been involved in every major U.S. war since 1790, from the quasi-war with France to the global war on terrorism. And matter of fact, the one guy that comes to mind whenever I think about people not realizing that the Coast Guard has provided its fleet and its highly trained sailors and Coast Guardsmen and women and pilots to all these different wars that we've been in. I think of Nate Bruckenthal, was a Coast Guardsman who was killed in the Iraq War. He was the first to die in wartime since Vietnam. Nate Bruckenthal and two U.S. Navy sailors were killed while intercepting a waterborne suicide attack on an offshore oil terminal off the coast of Iraq in the northern Persian Gulf in 2004. He was posthumously awarded the Bronze Star Medal with Combat Distinguished Device and Purple Heart for his action. So whenever I hear somebody say, oh, the Coast Guard doesn't do much, I call bullshit. And so I have covered, I think, just about every aspect of the human condition in all the years I've been doing radio and doing shows. But the one thing I've never done is a salute and a remembrance and a celebration to the Coast Guard that I spent, like I said, from 80 to 84 and then two more years in reserve. And so I thought, how am I going to do that? I mean, I suppose I could just, you know, pull a couple things together and read off some great stuff that they've done. And, you know, they're in the headlines sometimes for the wrong reasons. Last year it was because they weren't being paid, which is, that's a whole nother show. I'm going to kind of stay away from that. And, I mean, to use our military as bargaining chips in any sort of negotiation is the highest form of crap there could possibly be. And then the other part is like, well, what if I could gather some of the folks that I worked with and spent time with and served with and went on missions with and had a lot of fun with? What if I could do that and talk with them? So that's exactly what happened. So for the last month, I have been gathering data and finding my crewmates and shipmates from Coast Guard Air Station Chicago, where I spent a bulk of my time. And it wasn't easy. Some of these people I have not talked to for 30, 35, almost 40 years. And so what you're going to hear is a two-part series. I had to break it in half. I got, after editing, it was still 3 hours long. No one's, I wouldn't listen to that. So it's in two parts, and this is part one. You're going to be hearing from some incredible people, my CO, Captain Drombeck, and my Lieutenant, Rusty Muncy, and Brenda Woodfalk, who was the only female at the station back when that was sort of groundbreaking stuff. She came in the mid-70s, and she was there when I got there in 1980. And Dan the Man, Danny Manning, is truly, they're all one of a kind. All these people are just one of a kind. But DJ is the guy that first met me when I came out of boot camp back in June of 1980, when I walked up to the air station door and was banging out at 7 o'clock in the morning. And Roger Schenck, who just an incredible guy and a great technician, and was a roommate for a while at some point. Also had the best car in the Naval Air Station base, which was this very cool 1970 Camaro. So that's the first group, and then I'll be doing a little bit open for the second. And I know this is hard. Listen, especially this might be a little bit inside information for people, meaning if you weren't in the Coast Guard, some of this stuff would be like, yeah, so what? But what I'm hoping you'll do is listen to these people, even if you don't know them, obviously. And if you do, enjoy that. But these are the people that make up the backbone of any military organization. We all came from different backgrounds and callings to serve the country in war and peacetime. So as you go through this, listen to their stories, the things that they did, the incredible amounts of heroism, the dedication to duty, and I was just so proud, just so very proud to put this together. So let's get on with it. Here's Captain Drombeck. Hey, Cap. It's Augie.
Hey, how you doing, Augie?
I'm good. How you doing on end? Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine.
That's fantastic. I love technology when it works. When was the last time you were on the grounds there over in Glenview?
When I left Chicago. That was it.
That was it.
Yeah. So when I left the summer of 83, I don't recall that I was ever back there again, to be honest with you.
You wouldn't even recognize it, Captain. It's all gone. And the only thing left is the Navy tower. They kind of have that as like a little museum type thing. It's all restaurants, million-dollar homes. You couldn't tell where the front gate was or the back gate was or where any of the hangars were. It's all gone. It's truly amazing.
And the golf course is all gone, right?
Yeah, they got homes there. No more teeing off. It's all homes and you know, a lot of restaurants, things like that. And I was out there a couple, 3 years ago, and on one hand, it's pretty impressive what they did. But there was a lot of concrete that they had to cover out there because it was all runways.
Oh, yeah.
But you were telling me yesterday, Cap, that, you know, because I'm always interested in how people came to the Coast Guard. Everybody's got their story. And you were saying something like that just... You know, it was something you were going to try and see how it turned out. Is that right?
Well, you know, I finished up high school. I was making applications to colleges, and, You know, one day my father brought home this catalog from the Coast Guard Academy and, you know, kind of piqued my interest. And so, you know, I went ahead and applied to it also. And anyway, so when these, I pretty much got accepted to wherever. And I finally got accepted to Coast Guard. And I said, no, I don't know what I want to be. And the Coast Guard only had one standard curriculum for everybody. And I said, you know, if I go in there, maybe after eight years in the military, maybe I figure out what I want to be.
Uh-huh.
And so I ended up going to the Coast Guard Academy.
And how long were you in, Captain?
Well, I was in 30 years after the academy. So I guess you could say 34 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Once I graduated from the academy, I knew I wasn't thrilled with ships. Everybody that graduated had to go to a ship.
Right.
And I had made two cruises, summer cruises, they called them, at the academy, then went to a ship. And I said, you know, this shipboard life isn't for me, you know. Right. And so aviation, you know, some people got selected for aviation. So I applied for aviation and then I got accepted for aviation, became an aviator. Now you're obligated for another 5 years. You know, so now I'm already obligated for 9 years. Well, then I said, well, gee, I might as well go to graduate school. So I go off to graduate school. So now I'm obligated for another 2 years or something. So now I'm going to be in for over 10. So I'm going to say, well, I ought to stay for at least 20. You know, and then I got a couple of good jobs and I was cranking along pretty well, going up the ladder, and you know, so I ended up staying in. You know, after Chicago, I got one other big command at San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And loved it down there, and then ended up being the chief of operations for the Pacific area.
Hmm.
And I was acting chief of staff for about 6 months or so, and that was it.
Wow, that's quite a ride.
Yeah, I wasn't good enough or cut out to be an admiral, so I left at 30.
Yeah, well, listen, you know, so you came in 1981. I got there in June of 80, and Captain Allison was the CO of Seagas Chicago. Where were you?
Right.
Where were you before you came to Chicago? Where'd you come from?
Let me think. Oh, well, I was the executive officer at Los Angeles.
Oh, you were at L.A. So that's a big. That was a big station.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah. So I was executive officer at L.A. And then prior to that, I was the ops officer at San Diego.
So what was it like to go from Los Angeles, California, to a hangar with just two helos in it, outside of Chicago? Was that a big adjustment?
Well,
for you?
Actually, L.A. wasn't a big area. Actually, no. L.A. only had three helos.
Okay. I didn't know that.
And we weren't, actually the hangar at Chicago was a hell of a lot nicer than where we were in L.A., to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
We were on the LAX, the major airport in L.A., and it was an old post office building, and which obviously belonged to the transportation department then or something, and so we shared a hangar with God knows, I don't remember, Customs or FedEx or somebody, and it wasn't very big. I mean, yeah. The hangar space for the helicopters probably was smaller than what we had at Chicago.
Wow.
And we only had shops on like one side, Chicago, and then there was an upper floor, and then that was where our offices were.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. So, I mean, the hangar of Chicago was, hangar of Chicago was fairly new, and it was, you know, all by itself, and it was really nice.
You're coming into a new air station. You have this ragtag, a bunch of coasties that are, you know how that rolls. Everybody in the service has this character lineup. What was it like for you to come in and have to take command of all of us while we were there? Was that difficult? What's the biggest challenge in that for you?
Well, it really isn't so much only because you know, I'd already been, you know, I'd been the ops officer at San Diego. I'd been the executive officer at L.A. You know, so coming in as commanding officer wasn't necessarily a big deal for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'd be different. I mean, if you're coming in green or something, but I really wasn't coming in green. And I also had I had some heavy duty headquarters experience for about 4 years back there in a high powered office. You know, that really was into the heavy duty stuff of the Coast Guard.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I was pretty savvy on a lot of things.
I remember when you came in, I think one of your first orders was instituting beer bash every Friday. I think we tried they were great beer bashes too. So you're a pilot. When you became the CO, is flying not in on your schedule anymore? Is that what I remember? No, COs didn't fly? Or is that not true?
Well, here's the thing. Actually, Chicago wasn't bad because it was a small station, and there wasn't a whole lot of activity that I had to do there. So I did get some flying in at Chicago. Less than you normally would, certainly as a normal pilot at the air station. But
right.
I did get some flying in. And of course I was an aircraft commander in the H-52 because I had flown them, you know, I had flown quite a bit before. And so, so I, you know, I could go fly by myself or whatever. But, when I went to San Diego, both airplanes were different. The helicopter that we had there was the H-65 that replaced the H-52, so I wasn't qualified in it. And we had the HU-25s there, the jet, the Falcon jet. And so I'm sitting there going, you know, I'm getting out pretty soon, and, you know, maybe I can get a job with the airlines. And so, you know, why not go ahead and get qualified in the jet?
Right.
And so anyway, needless to say, I got qualified in the jet, and my God, I mean, I could only get in the airplane, fly maybe twice a month, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
You know, I heard in San Diego, you know, I was the senior Coast Guard guy there, and there's 15 goddamn admirals from the Navy and the Marine Corps and some Army guys there or whatever. And, you know, we've got meetings every day in the federal whatever board from San Diego, the Rotary Club, the Kiwanis Club, the, you know, and so, you know, I basically flew maybe twice a month.
Wow. You're a PR guy.
You know?
You're a PR guy.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And so, you know, it was embarrassing, you know, when I'd go out there flying as a co-pilot for these guys in the jet. My God, you know, they'd have to talk back to air traffic control half the time.
Yeah, yeah, oh, my gosh. That's.
I'm trying to write the clearance down, you know, and finally, you know, the damn lieutenant is spitting it back to the tower, you know, before I even finish. And so,
jeez.
And so all I was going along for a ride.
There you go.
You know, now I could fly the airplane and all
right.
You know,
right.
I could fly the airplane and so forth, but certainly not, I would not say that I was proficient.
I still to this day feel a sense of pride that because the Coast Guard was such a small service, it still is, you run into people more, you stay connected to people more than something like the Navy or the Air Force, even the Marines. And that it's kind of a sense of camaraderie and family that really kind of never goes away, you know?
Oh, without a doubt. The class that I graduated from the academy, everybody is still very close. We had just... you know, it's kind of like your radio program. We had just reached, I guess, last month. We had the first, I guess it'd been 50 years since we, 60 years, maybe it was 60 years from when we raised our right hand and took the oath to entering the Coast Guard.
You said
at the academy.
60 years, Captain? 60?
Well, let's see. We were, I we entered in 1960. That's 40 years. Yeah, 60 years.
Wow.
So anyway, one of the guys just said something out and said, just a reminder to everybody, you know, it's been 60 years since we took our oath of office into the Coast Guard. And then that started the emails rolling.
Mm.
And my God, we must have had 40 to 50 emails come out about that first day at the academy from the classmates. So there is that sort of camaraderie that continues to exist.
Mm. It's interesting, even though we haven't talked for over 20 years, when I hear your voice, I think I'm supposed to go get a beer, number one. Or we're supposed to... And it's a good thing. But I just want to tell you, if I've never did, and I must have at some point, I just have the highest respect for your service and what you did and who you were for all of us. Because, listen, it's like Animal House there sometimes. And you had a presence about you that you were part of us, but you were also... I mean, you were with us, but you were part of us, but we already knew where your office was and what you stood for. So I appreciate that, even all these years later.
Well, I certainly appreciate, and I certainly remember you, Augie.
You know, I'll tell you, it was interesting to me that across the board, maybe because, and everybody I talk to says the same thing, you know, Chicago was special. There was something about it. There are people who were very well-traveled, all say the same thing throughout the Coast Guard. It was just a great place to be, and whether you were flying the plane or fueling the plane. I don't know how many times we'd have to, you know, in the middle of winter just for a training flight, and I'd be standing out there making sure that Joe Sherrard's got, you know, the fuel going right. We're freezing our, you know, what's off. But everybody pitched in, and it was all kind of an even playing field, even whether you had, you know, scrambled eggs on your visor or not, or you're just out plowing the runway, you know?
Yeah, it was really a neat place because it was so small. Matter of fact, as long as we're speaking about Chicago, guys, I had my 55th reunion at the academy, and the XO there, who was Frank Redinger, I don't know if you remember him. I sure do. And Frank was living up near the academy because he ended up going from Chicago to be the navigation instructor at the academy. So he retired right in that area, and so we went over and had dinner with him one night, and it was really nice to, it's, you know, sitting back and reminiscing about old times.
Mm. First of all, I'm glad you're still around. We both know some of our crewmates that are gone.
Yeah, things are getting tight in my vintage. As a matter of fact, my academy class, we graduated around 110, and we've lost about 20 people already.
I appreciate you taking the time, and, you know, again, it was a great time in my life, and you put in 30 years, and thanks for doing that, and let's not make it another 25 years before we talk again.
Well, it was great talking to you, Augie. Hello.
Hey, Rusty.
Hey, John, how are you? I'm good to go. I'm in the car, but Susan's driving. Well, you picking up too much noise, let me know.
Not at all. Unless Susan wants to pull off to the side for about 25 minutes, I'm sure she'd enjoy that. How did you get in? I mean, what was your route to going into the Coast Guard?
Well, I'm old enough that they had the draft back then, and they sent me a draft notice to join the Army. Well, I'm a water person, so I was going to go join the Navy. And the guy I was working with said, "Have you ever heard of the Coast Guard?" And I said, "Nope, I haven't." So he said, "You should check them out. That's a good outfit." So I went to join the Coast Guard, and they said, "Oh, there's a year waiting list." And I said, "Well, I'm going to have to go join the Navy then." So I went home. That was on a Tuesday. And they called me on Thursday and said, "Somebody canceled. Do you want the spot?" I said, "Sure. When do they leave, or when do I leave?" He said, "Tomorrow." So that's how I got in the Coast Guard.
So what year would have that been?
That was in 1967.
Wow. So did you go right to OCS? How did that work for you?
No, I was actually enlisted for, I went all the way up through first class petty officer on active duty, then chief on reserves. And then I was in a reserve going to college, and then I came back in active and went to OCS after I was back active for 10 months.
When you were enlisted, were you on board ship?
I was not on a ship. I was stationed at Group Buffalo, at Loran Station, Kauai, and then at Group Miami as electronic technician.
Wow. I didn't know any of that stuff. See what I learned 45 years later? When did you know you were going to go into aviation?
Well, from the very beginning, because I was up in Buffalo and they would come down and do boat hoist. And I said, man, I'd like to do that. So I set my goal on doing it. And then, of course, 10 years later, I got there.
10 years.
Yep. Took me 10 years through my active enlisted and then reserve going to college. And then I got there.
Yeah. I always tell people it's kind of like the Rodney Dangerfield of the military. We never get no respect. However, when you need us, you're all coming in. We were always going out, so that's a good thing.
That's right. Yeah, we're always ready.
Always. So where were you? Did you come from OCS right to Chicago? Where were you before that?
From OCS, I went to headquarters to be an inspector.
Okay.
And then from there, I went to flight school in Pensacola, and then right out of flight school, I went to Chicago.
So when you and I first met in 80, you were there already. You had just come out of flight school.
That's correct.
Wow. How was that like for you to go from flight school, and then, you know, you're on the deck there? I mean, if this isn't school anymore, it's the real deal. What was that like?
Well, it was, now I was going to go be something that I was trained to do, but really I didn't know the Coast Guard steps to do it. So when I got there, they just trained me on, because I was already an aviator, so they just trained me how to do everything. And because they didn't have any openings in the flight training down in Mobile, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
So they trained me there for about 3 or 4 months, and then the opening came in Mobile, and I went to Mobile and trained there with the Coast Guard. And when I was there, the guy said, because we were doing hoisting, well, they'd already trained me up in Chicago. So when I went to do the hoisting, I pulled over the boat to do the hoisting. He looked at me and said, you've done this before, haven't you? Because he didn't know.
Yeah.
He didn't know that I'd been up there for that long.
So. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, and then, but that's different doing the training than it is going out on the lake. And everybody said the same thing. You know, I don't think people, unless you live on the Great Lakes, especially Lake Michigan, and then, of course, Lake Superior, these are like inland seas. They're nothing to mess with, and that's a little different from training to being into the real deal. So the second question was, is there ever a time, and you and I have a shared experience about that little sunfish sailboat thing or that little skipboard that guy.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in a second. But was there any, I don't know, near misses or ones where you thought, man, you really came out of there with your back wet?
Well, there were two experiences up there in Chicago. One when I had the ditch with Captain Corson, and then there was another one when that helicopter went down with all of the vice presidents of a company, and Rod Leland and I were flying.
Mm.
And what he did was really marvelous in that you think about how you're doing things, because he called control and asked them if anybody had seen an oil slick. Well, I was too young to realize that as far as aviation goes. And some airliner said, I saw an oil slick, and gave the position, and we went there, and there was the guys
floating
in a boat.
They hadn't.
Yeah,
it hadn't even been called in or anything?
Oh, yeah, they had called Mayday,
okay.
But it was getting dark, and we couldn't see to do anything. And that one jetliner that reported he saw the oil slick was the key to getting those people out of the water.
Wow. And Rod Leland, you know, left way too soon. He was an incredible guy. Imagine flying with him must have been always a treat.
It was, because he had all the experience and the knowledge, and he was always calm. So
yeah,
he taught you to be calm, too. So it was really great.
I always tell people in these conversations we've had, you know, if you look at Top Gun, like Steve Zimek was Tom Cruise, and Rod Leland would be like another one of the pilots. Those two guys, most and next to you, stand out in my memory of, like, if you had to get in the helo, those are the guys you want to be with.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. That's right. I can't help it. I can't help it. I'm sorry. What, yeah. That's right, Augie. What about... talk about that. I know I already heard this yesterday, but you got to expand on that thing with Captain Corson about having to ditch.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, we were flying out to do some training, and our guy, crewman in the back, he said, well, actually, he didn't say anything. The captain, I said, man, do you smell that? And I said, yeah, I smell something burning. And the guy in the back, he said, there's oil going all over everywhere back here. So what happened was a quick disconnect for the transmission came loose and dumped all the transmission fluid. So we were at 1,000 feet, so I made a mayday call on FM, UHF, and single sideband, and we ditched in the water there. And they came out that evening, because they came out and picked us up. The other helicopter was down, so they had to come out in a boat, and they towed the 52 back into the lifeboat station in South Chicago. And then the next day, they put a transmission in it and flew it home.
You know, I just, for full disclosure, we remembered yesterday when we were talking off the air that the guy in the back that was saying, there's oil everywhere, that was the that was the one and only, the armadillo from Texas, Lonnie Shear.
That's right. That's
Man,
who it was.
He was a trippin'. This is the only guy I ever saw walking around the hangar deck with a flight suit on and cowboy boots.
Yeah.
Yeehaw.
He was a character.
So the one that I remember that you were part of, I was on the radio the night that little girl got lost, and I remembered up on the North Shore somewhere, Evanston, and there was a birthday party, and she had gotten like a sunfish sailboat or a little skipboard sailboat kind of thing, and they lost her for a while, and I don't remember, the things that I remember was getting the call came in, but they waited like an hour to call her, 45 minutes, because they were looking for her. They didn't realize, and if you wait that long, and you're out on the water, you know, those waves can take you right out, and she was, you know, was quite a ways out in the lake, and search and rescue ensued, and found her, and she was alive, and that was good. By the time you guys were coming back in, the news was all over the hangar. Somebody let them in the back gate because it was news. The word had gotten out, and it was news, and there was a thing on the hangar deck and everything, and I watched people get interviewed and everything, and it was a great deal. But the thing I remember most was that her dad walked over to a group of us and said, hey, fellas, you know, I really appreciate you finding my daughter out there, but any chance you were able to salvage the sailboat? I mean, it cost me $900. I thought we were going to pummel this guy. We should have short-sheeted him and hung him up on the hangar deck. I couldn't believe that.
Yeah, people are like that. But that we searched. I wasn't one of the pilots, but okay. They searched all night long. And the next morning, when the sun came up, they saw her laying on her board.
Right.
I don't know if she was asleep, but she was curled up, you know, in the fetal position to stay warm. And she was fine. Maybe a little hypothermic, but she was fine because, you know, the water was always cold up there.
Yes. Yeah. You know, again, if you even a couple three, you know, if you when you drive on Lakeshore Drive here in Chicago, and if you look on the lake side of that outer drive, you can see those cribs, the 5 mile crib for feeding the water line back to the city. That's a long way away, and even anywhere between there and 5 miles is a long way. But once you start getting out towards the middle, man, it's a scary place to be. And I don't think she was very old, 12, 14 years old, somewhere in there.
Well, the board, like you said, was only 14 feet long at nighttime. Yeah. That was really before night vision goggles were popular or in use. So even though we could search all night, what are you going to see? It's pitch black out there. So when the light came up, they found her.
There was a few times when that bell would go off at night, the SAR alarm would go off. We'd have to hook up the night sun. Could you tell people that are listening, I mean, all the Coasties are listening, especially aviation, and even the other guys will get it, but for the uninitiated, what was it like to have to work with the night sun hooked up underneath that helo?
Well, it was actually mounted on the left side, just in front of the sponson, and that light would beam out I can't remember how many looms it had, but it was bright, and it was great for searching back then because it was huge and big light.
It was remote, right? One of the co-pilot or
something? Yeah, we could move it around to where we wanted to have it. We had a little control to do that, yes. It wasn't just fixed pitch. You moved it to where you needed it.
That thing was heavy. I remember there was a couple of them hanging off to the side, and they're like, hey, Augie, go pick that up and hold it while we put it on the plane. I'm like, what? And that so you're in for 26. When I was there, you went from a JG to a lieutenant. Did you continue on, or was that where you kind of leveled off?
No, I went from there. I went on to Mobile, and I was an instructor there in the Dolphin, one of the original instructors. And then I went to Barbers Point, and I transitioned to fly C-130s and E-2 because I left there and went to fly E-2s in St. Augustine. I made lieutenant commander, and then I retired.
One of my most enduring memories of you is, and I'm still pretty coherent, even though, I mean, you're like, what, 80 now, something like that, 85? Anyway.
72.
So you got 10 years on me, so I'm still pretty coherent. But one time, and I don't know if you remember this, over a period of time, you were kind of pushing me. You know, hey Augie, there's an opening at OCS. Why don't you go become a pilot? You remember this stuff? Pushing me a little bit.
Yeah.
So I never...
That's because you were gung-ho, and you were always there, and you always did a great job. That's the kind of people you want.
Well,
in the cockpit with you.
And then, so that happened more than once. And the one time that I remember the most, I don't know where we were going, what was going on, but I do know that there was some sort of something going up in Wisconsin, like a ski trip for that some of the crew had gone on this ski trip. I got in the seat and we're flying along, and I don't remember who was in the back, but you said, let's go check on those guys. And we're going up Route 12, and you said, now, I don't know if you remember this. It's vivid to me, Rusty. You said, here, why don't you fly for a while? I go, well, what? And so I had my hand on the collective, and I'm just sitting there. And he's like, just take it easy. It's kind of like balancing a poo ball on a needle. Terrific. So we're going along, and all you said was, you dropped a little bit, about 300 feet. I'll take it from here. So, but, you know, that was such a great memory for me, and I think about it, and
actually, what had happened, they went to Iron Mountain where they went.
That's what it was. You're right.
They went to Iron Mountain, and what had happened was I volunteered to be the chairman of the Navy committee for, you know, doing all of the trips and being able to do things. And by doing that, then I was able to get stuff for the Coast Guard. And what we did is we got the Navy bus to take everybody up to the Iron Mountain.
So you remember
that. So that's how that happened.
Iron Mountain. Okay. And all I remember is we were going up Route 12, and I'm like, what do we follow? You said, well, you just follow that road down there. What? Anyway.
Well, you know, that helicopter only had one engine, so you wanted to stay close to the road, so if you had to auto-rotate, you had a place to go.
That's right. But you almost had me at that one. I was really close. I came out, I thought, well, if he could do this, I could do this. And I don't even remember what year it was, but... my life was supposed to go in a different direction, but you know, one of the great joys is our friendship over the years. I mean, I just think the world of you and Susan and you're just an unforgettable character and friend in my life. And I thank you for that.
Well, I do the same. That's why we stay in touch with each other because you came over to my house at Santa Claus and treated my kids well. So every Christmas while we were there, we had Santa Claus come over and hand my girls gifts. Yeah.
Well, listen, it's always good to talk to you, and I appreciate you, you know, chiming in on this. I not just to remember and spend time with the people that were there, but also to let people who know who weren't there, you know, kind of what it was like and how important the 5th Military Branch is. So thanks so much.
Yeah. One more thing. Don't forget old Bob Lyons. He was up there with us too, having time with his dog.
What a cast of characters. Bob Lyons showed up one day with this beat-up red Matador or Nova or something, this old car. And he had that, what was that, a sheepdog?
I think so, but what he showed up with was a Maverick.
That's it, Maverick.
And he had put a V8 in it, but it didn't run.
He parked it over by the dumpster. And I think he lived in there for a time. And he had that dog, he named that dog Paco. I remember this.
Yeah, Bob was a good guy. He was really fun to have there, too. Yeah,
absolutely.
All right. Thanks, Augie. Appreciate it.
All right,
it's always good to hear from you.
Yes, sir.
Roger.
What's up, man?
Man. Well, it's like 100 years since I talked to you.
No kidding.
I've done all these podcasts. I've been in radio 23, 24 years now, and I got into podcasting about 5 years ago. I've covered everything you can possibly imagine I think would have people's interest, but I've never done anything like kind of talking about the Coast Guard, the most, what, it's, we're like the Rodney Dangerfield of the military. No respect.
Oh yeah.
So that's why we're doing it. So I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, no problem.
So the first question is, so I ask everybody the same thing. How did you come to join the Coast Guard?
So for me, that's a pretty funny story. So getting near the end of high school, and I knew I didn't want to go to college. I just wasn't ready to do it. I didn't want to do any more school. And so I started looking at military. And in my family, my mom was a Navy chief. My dad was Army and then Navy. My uncle was a Marine, and I've got seven brothers and one sister. And so out of them, I had one that was Army. I had two brothers and a sister that were Navy. And I had three brothers that were Air Force. So I'm looking at them like, well, nobody's done the Coast Guard yet. So I'm not kidding. That was kind of how it started. And then I started looking at it a little bit, and it was like, you know how it was when we were in. It was the height of the Cold War stuff.
Yeah.
The rest of the branches weren't doing anything, really. You know, I mean, little stuff here and there, and I'm sure, like, spec ops guys were doing all kinds of crazy stuff. But for the most part, if you went in one of the other branches, you were going to probably be repairing stuff and sitting around. And I'm looking at what the Coast Guard does, and that sounds like fun. So that's kind of how it all came about. It was like, well, nobody's done this one yet, so I think I'll try it.
That's cool. So did you go to Cape May or Alameda?
I went to Cape May.
But you're the first guy talking ever went to Cape May.
I'm the only one that went to the real boot camp, is what you're saying.
Oh, here we go. Skate May.
You know, that whole thing, I don't think either one of them were a lot of fun.
No. For me, I think it was like 12 or 13 weeks. Was it that long at Cape May? When did you go to Cape May?
It was that. I went through Cape May in June of 80, and it was actually 8 weeks. They had just cut it down when I think from 9 or 10 before that.
Yeah.
They took out stuff like the week of working in the kitchen and some of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But what was funny for me is I ran cross country and track all 4 years of high school. So I get to boot camp and, you know, they think they're going to make you run. My times actually got worse through the 8 weeks. I was like, dude, I'm not running enough.
Oh, my God. You know, it's funny because you're 100% right. For guys that are, see, you're built to run. I don't like to run, right?
Yeah.
So when I got out there, I had no problem doing all the push-ups and stuff, but please don't make me run. And we ran our backsides off for the whole time on the grinder. Let me just tell you, on the grinder in the heat of Oakland, not like that in Cape May, pal. You guys were just waltzing around in the nice weather.
I don't know. Cape May in June and July was humid and hot.
Yeah.
I'm sure, like, spring fall guys, it was cake.
Yeah.
But it was hot. But like I said, I was in worse shape. I think I gained 15 or 20 pounds in the 8 weeks.
Hey, man.
Because
as I remember, you could probably use 15 to 20 pounds.
Probably slim guy. Still could.
Yeah.
Probably still could. But yeah, but I was running, 10, 12 miles a day.
Oh,
before I went to boot camp.
And that's just wrong. Wrong on all levels.
They get out there and they're like, you're going to run a mile and a half. I'm like, all right, what are we doing now?
So you went to school first and then to Chicago or the opposite? How did it work? I don't remember.
I went to Cape May. From there, I went to a buoy tender.
Oh, boy.
For a year.
There's a good time.
180. Oh, man. It was a 180 seagoing. I tell you what, though. I learned how to work there better than anywhere else.
Mm.
I mean, we busted our butts.
Yeah.
And then I did that for a year. Then I went to A school down in North Carolina. From there, I went to Kodiak for a year and a half. And then from there to Chicago. And so Chicago was really the last place I was before I got out.
So you went to the air station at Kodiak?
Yeah, yeah. I was actually in C-130s up there.
Wow. So
don't ask me how I got
52s
coming out of there. I just asked for it. And the deal is, you know, if you go do Kodiak, you kind of, if you put down your top three choices, you're going to get your number one anyway. And I wanted to come back to Chicago, so they dumped me there, you know.
Yeah, yeah. What about when you left Kodiak to come back to Chicago?
So, Kodiak is the biggest.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as air stations. The other thing about Kodiak is they get every piece of equipment they get is the newest. And then they rotate the stuff out of there to the other places because nobody wants to be out there over the Bering Sea and some of the stuff, you know, we flew in Chicago. But, so it was kind of a culture shock a little bit because, the one place that I was stationed where the Coast Guard was respected and loved and by the whole community was Kodiak.
Yeah.
Because it was like probably a third of the population.
Sure.
You know, of the island. And the rest of the population were all fishermen. So they wanted us to be, you know, on their good side.
Absolutely.
But so, yeah, it was a little bit of a culture shock. And on top of that, I'd never been stationed anywhere where we were borrowing space from somebody else. Like, we, you know.
Yeah.
You know how it was. The Navy kind of looked at us like, who are those idiots over in the corner? You know,
I know. So. The only people they looked down on worse was that Army Reserve hangar that was even further behind. Remember those guys?
Yeah, the Hueys that used to make sparks at night when they do their auto rotation.
I know. Two things. One is, you weren't in the helos in Kodiak, so I would guess that the duty on the C-130 was pretty constant because of just where you were based. Was it the pace had to be?
We flew a ton. We did a lot of, at that time, the Coast Guard still had the Lion Sea stations for navigation. They had them on Attu and up above the Arctic Circle and stuff. The cool thing was, being in C-130s up there, if there was a runway in Alaska, even dirt, I've been there. I mean, I've been all the way out the Aleutian Chain to Attu, Shenya, Ada, all of those, and then above the Arctic Circle, the Barrow and Port Clarence and all that stuff. So it was cool that I had the opportunity to go everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew a lot. I mean, because of that, and it's changed now. I don't know if you've watched any of those shows now, but like the medevacs and stuff up there are all handled by a little contracting company.
Yeah, yeah.
But we did all that in C-130s. So we would, somebody had a heart attack out in the middle of nowhere, we'd go pick them up.
Wow.
You know, so we've, and the other thing up there, and well, Chicago was the same way a little bit. We flew in some nasty weather.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. And I was thinking of, the only time I was ever in a C-130 was when I was in Alameda, and I was part of like the rifle team, and they'd fly us around for parades and stuff, you know, because that's good use of the tax dollars. Send us out on parade.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
They would load us up in a C-130 somewhere, wherever it was, the airbase was in probably Oakland, I guess. And then
One in Sacramento, but I don't. Yeah, there may have been another one. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know where we flew from somewhere to go to Seattle to perform at the King Dome, and we flew over. We flew over Mount St. Helens like a month after it had erupted, and it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen.
Oh yeah.
Is there any one or two events or thoughts about any of the search and rescue efforts that you were on that really stand out over the time either Kodiak or Chicago?
As far as Chicago, the only one I really remember that we found the guy's baseball hat. But I remember
What?
That's all we found.
Oh man!
It was up in Wisconsin somewhere, and it was one of those where it always seemed like that too, especially up in Alaska. You'd be just about ready to get off of duty, so it's early morning, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, we got to go look for somebody. Yeah. This guy was fishing up. I don't know exactly where, but on a pier just in Wisconsin somewhere. And a wave came in and he disappeared and his buddy was still sitting there.
Oh my God.
And so we went up and it was foggy and, you know, we went up, we searched for a while, we had to refuel and then go back out. And all we ever found was a baseball hat, and it was, the assumption was that it was this guy's baseball hat. But, but I just remember the fogginess. I mean, it was like, oh, geez, what are we going to run into, you know?
Mm-hmm.
One cool one in Kodiak, we, this, you know, I don't know, I'm sure you've watched The Guardian.
Yes.
And you know how they talk about the rescues and how stupid the people are.
Yes.
This is one of those like that. So this husband and wife were canoeing in the spring in Kodiak with their newborn baby.
Ugh.
And they flip their canoe over and they can't find the baby. You know, they're freaking out. They get a hold of people. I don't know if, I think it was a helicopter crew or a small boat went out there and flipped the canoe over, and the baby's under the canoe.
Oh.
And has been for 30 or 40 minutes.
Oh, boy.
In the water, face down. Luckily, it's Alaska, so the water's real cold.
Sure.
They brought the baby back to, started doing CPR, brought the baby back to the air station at Kodiak, where we had a C-130 cranked up, ready to go, because there was no way the hospital on Kodiak was going to handle it. So we took off for Anchorage. And I was up front, I was up on the flight deck, so I wasn't seeing what was going on. But the guys in the back were doing CPR on this baby. And as the baby warmed up, by the time we got to Anchorage, it was crying. And everybody, the doctors and stuff, thought it would be fine.
Wow.
So it was a real cool, you know, it was real cool to be involved in. I wasn't, like, instrumental.
Right, right. But you were there. Yeah, I get it.
But, yeah, oh, yeah. You know, and there were tons of medevacs and things like that. But those are the ones that stick out.
Hmm.
Actually, the funny story, I got a podcast with a buddy of mine who's a pastor a few years ago, and he was asking me, what typical, when's the one time you felt like you were most likely to die?
Mm. Good question.
Which, and so when I tell him the story, I said, there's lots of times it's bad weather, kind of like we were just talking about. But so when I was seaman apprentice or seaman on the buoy tender, we did New York Harbor, all the buoys coming in and out of New York Harbor. So they're pretty critical to the trade coming in and out.
Mm-hmm.
And got a call, it was probably February or March in New York, but you know what that weather's like.
Yep.
It was freezing, cold. They had one light out on a buoy way out that lined people up as they came into the harbor. They're not going to get a ship underway to go fix one light. So the BM1 says, come with me, you know, we're going over here. And so I grab a bag of tools and lights and stuff like that, and we drive over to Brooklyn, get on a 44-foot motor lifeboat, you know, the corks that can flip over at the time.
Yep.
And I get on this thing, and the boat's big, like, yeah, just go with them. He's sitting at the, you know, at the station drinking coffee, and I go out with these guys on this boat. And it's like probably, I don't know, at least 6 foot seas, maybe a little more than that. So we're just going up and down and up and down. We get out to this buoy, and I got to get from the 44 footer onto the buoy.
Uh-huh.
And it's freezing cold. Everything's covered in ice.
Wow.
And it didn't hit me until later, but after we were all done and going back, these guys on this boat were telling me, man, you're crazy. and I'm thinking, these guys do this on this boat that flips over every day and they think I'm crazy. So we get out there and the boat's going down, you know,
yeah,
four to 6 feet, and the buoy's going up 4 to 6 feet, and they're doing it at opposite times. And I'm not wearing like a survival suit or anything.
Oh,
just
man.
Regular winter stuff. And I got a tool bag strapped over my shoulder. And so I'm just watching this thing and I time it. And as the boat's going down and the buoy's coming up, I jump and grab onto the rack of this buoy. And they're big. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the ocean.
Oh, yeah.
Ones, but they're,
yeah,
they're big.
Yeah.
And so I get inside the cage of that thing and I climb up to the top, and talk about a ride. I mean,
man,
I get up there, I get the light all changed, you know, and then I'm like, okay, well, that was easy because, yeah, I jumped over and I've got this cage to grab onto. Now I got to go back to the deck of this cork with a sheet of ice across it.
Oh, man.
So, and you know, I was like 18 years old at the time, invincible, you know, how, yeah, we were back then.
Yeah.
And so I go to jump back, and I'm thinking, I'm just going to try and plant anywhere in the middle of the big deck area. Oh. And so I dive. The guys are kind of watching me, and we kind of are doing motions, you know, nods, that kind of thing. I dive back, and they basically pig pile tackle me. So that all of us stay on the deck of this boat.
God.
And then, you know, we get in, we go back, and that's when they're telling me, man, dude, you're crazy.
Man, there's
and like, no, just.
Yeah, just young
just
enough.
Too young.
Exactly.
Smart.
Like, so how long, when did you get out? How long were you in?
I got out in 84. Oh. I was in almost 5 years.
Yeah, so right after me. See, I got out in July of 84. Okay. Is there any.
Yeah, so I got out in the fall of 84.
Any, and I got to tell you, this was interesting. You said something earlier that I think people, this needs to be repeated. When we were there, the Cold War thing was still going on. I can remember, and you probably do too, there were times while we were there, we were waiting to hear at midnight if they pulled our funding.
Oh,
remember this?
I don't know how many times we would that budget time would come up, and we would wonder if we were going to get a paycheck.
I know.
I remember that. Yeah,
and
the other Cold War thing.
Go ahead.
The other Cold War thing that was interesting was being on 130s out of Kodiak. We did a patrol up the dateline between Russia and the U.S., and there would be lots of times when we're doing that, where we would get a couple blips on the radar coming from Russia. And they do that. I mean, people hear it now and they're like, oh my goodness, Russia's doing this. They do it all the time. They probably always have.
Mm-hmm.
But they would send a couple planes and they would just see how far they could fly towards the U.S. before somebody turned them around. And we would see them on the radar. We saw a couple of times where we could see them visually, but they were off in a distance. And usually what would happen is, we'd make a call or somebody else would see them first. A couple of F-16s would scramble out of Shimmy Air Force Base and go up that way, and then the Russians would turn around and go back, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But it was a weird feeling knowing you're in this big white plane with a stinking huge stripe on it,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
And you got Russians coming at you.
So... Outside of having the coolest car on Naval Air Station Glenview, that 70 Camaro, man, come on. Remember that? That was the coolest car on the whole base. Is there any, like, takeaways from your 5 years, whether it was at Kodiak or Seagas, that kind of stay with you today? Any big ahas?
Yeah, well, you know, the whole thing to me, the stuff that I got out of really my whole time, all the way from boot camp, you know, buoy tender and the air station, obviously the air guys were the best, but the whole teamwork and having each other's back.
Yep.
I mean, sometimes you and I know this, we had each other's back for probably the wrong reason.
I'm editing that out for sure, but go ahead.
But you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
I mean, I've worked with some great people over the years since then, but I've never had that situation where I know for a fact if something goes really bad that this person isn't going to turn tail on me, you know?
Yep.
And that's one of those things that I think, you know, it would benefit a lot of our youth today to have to at least do a couple years of that.
Man, do I agree with that.
And come out with that. I mean, and I learned how to work. I mean, like I said, on the buoy tender, it was hard work. And, you know, we goofed off a lot, but we got done what had to be done. And, you know, I learned all of that. And then the whole respect thing.
Yep.
So it just, to me, that's the stuff that I took away that always make me wonder, man, should I have stayed in for 20 or, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
When you look back, I'm sure you've done that too. It's like
every other day.
Then the older you get, the worse it gets.
Hey, Matt, it's so good to hear your voice. I'll talk to you soon.
Yep, sounds good.
My Augie doggie.
one of the first people to ever call me that actually was you. I always had the Augie part, but not the doggie.
Yes, Augie Doggie. I had to, because you used to do such crazy things to me in the office. You come in and you just make me laugh for no reason at all. And I loved it so much. I had so much fun with you, John.
Well, I wanted to make sure that all my pay records were taken care of and everything else.
Absolutely. And you know, I had to take care of you. You and my Dan the Man.
Yep.
What a great, great unit that we had there at Air Station Chicago.
So putting this little podcast together to talk about the Coast Guard, I kept thinking about how everybody had their own unique view of it. And you and Danny were in admin, and everybody was talking during these conversations about, you know, you can go out and put a new transmission in the helicopter, or you could be out, you know, plowing the runways and stuff. But if admin wasn't straight, we weren't straight, you know?
That's correct. We had to have your records right. If you had to go to school, if you had a new baby or divorces, we had a few of those. But any kind of paperwork, we had to take care of it. And it was always fun to interact with everybody because you got to know everybody on a personal basis. Mm-hmm. Everyone. You knew a little bit about everybody. And, of course, we always had jocks and socks, and that was always fun, too.
Who else gets 90 minutes for lunch and basketball?
Exactly! and kick all the Marines and the Army Navy. Behind on the base, yes.
Exactly right. We were
basketball, softball, football. It was we were the best. I was the cheerleader, so I can say we had the best athletes.
How did you get into the Coast Guard? What was your path?
Before high school, my friend and I were going to join the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
Well, her mom said, "No, you can't go." I went down to the recruiting office to tell them that we weren't going on the buddy plan, and he wasn't there. Coast Guard recruiter was there. He was like, "What are you doing down here?" I said, "Well, I just came to tell him that, you know, we weren't going to join because my friend can't come, and I'm not going by myself." He said, "You don't want to be a Marine. Come on over here. Let me tell you about the Coast Guard." So that's how I ended up in the Coast Guard. I took the test that day and signed up. But, of course, in 1975, when I signed up, women were only going at the rate of one every 2 months.
Wow.
So from April of 75 till March of 76, I was on delayed enlistment.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got there, it was only five women in the company.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's how I ended up in the Coast Guard.
Did you go to Cape May? Was there a separate?
Absolutely. Cape May, yes.
Yeah, how did that
work? Five women, and we had maybe 45 men.
Wow.
Five women. Oh, yes. Absolutely. It was interesting because if one woman got reverted, which none from my company did, but you would end up in a company of guys.
Oh, no.
I had a friend that was in the company of all guys. She was the only woman in a company of like 45 guys.
Wow.
I felt bad for her because they would have to send somebody because all the women were in one squad bay.
Mm-hmm.
And the men, of course, they were in their own squad bay. And they would have to send somebody to get her.
Huh.
And when we had our company, you know, it'd be five or six of us getting ready, and she would be only one poor thing. But she survived it, and I haven't talked to her for a while, but she retired from the Coast Guard, too.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that was kind of groundbreaking stuff. You're talking, what year was this?
That was 76, March 1st, 1976.
Wow.
That's when I went to boot camp, and I graduated May 7th.
Mm-hmm.
May 30th of that year, and went to New York, Governor's Island.
Oh boy!
Yes.
So were you admin right out of boot camp?
Absolutely not.
I didn't think so.
No way. I was what they call a running seaman. What I had to do, I was cutting grass, painting curbs. Learn how to use a buffer. And, of course, you know, when you first start buffing, it'll throw you all. Oh, I know you had to do it because we had some floors. Yeah.
I remember a lot of late nights making sure those floors are right in that buffer all over the place.
And that, yeah. And it, you know, they don't really tell you how to do it.
Yeah.
You, and of course, our little arms, you know, it threw me all over the place. It did. I finally got it down to a science. Yeah. But, and then, of course, we had to go out on the boats because it was a small boat station. So we had 30-footers. Mm-hmm. Was it 30s? Yeah, 30s. And 32 boats. And we had to go out and train in New York Harbor.
Wow.
And that was another interesting thing going out there.
So how did you end up in Chicago 4 years later? Or was it even 4 years later?
Exactly. It was, I got to Chicago January of, 79. I reenlisted.
Okay.
And that was my promotion. I mean, that was my getting to a new place. I wanted to come back to home. Mm-hmm. And, so they said, well, we got Air Station Chicago. I said, ooh. Okay, I'll take it. Like, about, 70 miles from home, but yeah. I didn't think I had to go through downtown Chicago to get there.
Yeah.
But, yes, I got there in January of 80.
Remember who the admin boss was? There was it McClendon or another guy? I don't remember.
I think we had McClendon, and then we had Mr. Robbins, and he had a nice beard.
Yeah.
And, you know, at that time they could have a beard.
Yeah.
So it was Robbins, and then we got Lieutenant J.G. Angert.
I remember Jim Angert.
Yes. He was hilarious. That's who used to tease me about all the time.
Oh, my gosh. And I remember in order to grow a beard, you had to get a chit to grow a beard, right?
Absolutely. You know, you probably could count a couple of people on one hand. Lonnie Shear.
Oh.
Yes. Armadillo.
Ah!
And Roth wore a beard.
Keith Roth.
Yes. And I think Ted Young.
Ted Young.
The ASM.
Yeah, we were talking
about
him.
Now, he had the real little Augie Doggie.
That's exactly right.
Boy, yeah.
That was one of the memories I have of you. Remember we used to have to go out and do training in the lake in a raft?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, why you got to bring that up, John? You know I was afraid of water.
And we didn't know what to do with you. So I remember one time in like 82, 83, and they were taking us out in groups, and they would...
Oh, God. I remember landing on the water in the helicopter.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, I didn't think that thing would float. It had those little floats on the side. And I'm holding my feet up in the helicopter like, please. And you guys are out there in the water just having a blast. Just floating around, I'm like, please, Lord, please, let this thing float. That was horrible.
I remember we all were worried about you because we all knew that you know you didn't want to do it, but you had to do it. Like once a year, we had to do that.
Yes,
we tried to figure out how we were going to get you from the Hilo to the raft without you getting wet. Well, that wasn't possible. I remember we kind of formed a human chain and made sure you got there, and we were out there and you got back. Yes you did.
You guys always kept me safe. You looked out for me when I was the duty driver and had to plow the ramp. And I didn't know how to, boy, y'all just don't know.
Wait a minute.
I tore that little plow up. You all don't know it, do you?
I was just going to say, I remember a couple times. I remember a couple times. There's a bunch of us watching you from the office.
Oh, no, you were not.
Yes.
See, you all never told me that.
And you were at the far end of the ramp, and they had that blue Ford tractor.
Yep.
And
yes.
Didn't have any heat in it.
Right. My toes were frozen. My toes were like ice.
and
you know, wait a minute. You guys give me little quick instructions like, okay, when you go in reverse, you got to lift the blade. I never remember to lift the blade. No, I know. I know. I destroyed it.
We used to sit there and watch you.
You kidding me?
And that blade be turning left and right and back and forth, and you and we're like, she's gonna rip that right off the frame. So great.
But you guys would come and you say, "Look, go ahead." So that's what you guys were doing, watching me, and then you come and say, "I'll do it. I'll do it." And I got out of doing that part.
Right. Listen, you know, I told you before we got on the air, and I'm so glad we're talking. We literally haven't heard each other's voices since 1984.
Yes, and that's for sure. It's been so long.
Long
so
time.
Long.
And it's just like yesterday to me. I remember all
yes,
this.
Yes, you know? It is. You brought back so many memories for me, John. And I loved Air Station Chicago, and especially, you know, you forgot when you stood watch, you had to do... the teletype machine.
Oh, yes.
Letters and figures.
Jeez.
Yeah. You get down to typing and then you mess up.
Oh, no.
And you have to tape that tape back together so it would run through and print your message. Oh, God.
Remember?
Yeah, and then you have, of course, to keep the helo up. Every 15 minutes, was it?
12 minutes.
Flight ops, and status.
Every 12 minutes, you got to go call and see, make sure they're still alive.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Good stuff. You know, for a while, you were the only female, but then wasn't a little bit later somebody came, replaced you? I don't remember her name.
Yes. Okay. I don't think you were there when Mary White was there.
No.
She had a little girl, and she was, she lived out in, I forgot the name of the city, not far from, Glenview, and then Veronica White.
Oh, yeah, V. White, yes. I remember
She came and replaced me.
Yeah.
But I was the only woman there for a while.
Yeah.
The only black, and then we got Jeffrey Humbles.
Wait, you were black?
Yeah, I was black.
No, you know, interesting that the times we live in now, nobody cared about that back then.
Exactly. We did not. I never experienced any racial prejudice at Air Station Chicago. Only one incident in the city, and that was it.
Mm-mm-mm.
But never at Air Station Chicago. Everybody was fun, exciting, and we were there for a mission.
Mm-hmm.
We accomplished it, and there were no problems. Problems at all.
I always thought it was like Animal House.
You know, yes, it was.
You look at the cast of characters at that place.
My Art Schneider. I can't forget him.
Oh.
Don't forget about Art. Art used to bring my car in, showed me how to change my oil. You know, when wintertime, they would let us bring out cars in the hangar deck. That was, woo-hoo! You could wash and clean your car up Yeah, it was like Animal House. We had a good time. We had good commanders, and they taught me a lot. Coming from a small boat station and then going to an air station, things were definitely different. It was a whole... air stations were great for me because the camaraderie was a lot better. We had the closeness. And everybody was family. I mean, there were units where I was part of the family, but it was a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And I always longed for Air Station Chicago. Always wanted to go back. But
great time, course, great memories. Artie Schneider spent 40 years in.
Really?
He just retired.
You're kidding! Oh, my God. Wow.
Yeah, I'd have to go look it up. He was running like Station Humboldt Bay by the time he was there. He was a CO.
Really?
Yeah, and I remember him as Artie from Ohio.
Yes.
Wow.
Young, handsome, go-getter.
Yep.
Oh, my. He was well on his way. I knew he was going to be something special because he was really a special guy. I love you guys. Man, I tell you, you have made my day today. Really have.
It goes both ways. So if there's with 20 years in... And you had such a unique view of it from admin and different, stations that you're at, people you work with, whether it's Seagas or in New York. Is there a big aha for you after 20 years in the Guard and what you witnessed?
When I was in Alameda, our ship went up to Alaska a lot. and The Deadliest Catch, believe me, I lived it. Uh-huh. I mean, there were days we couldn't go outside. Mm. And because the weather was so bad, so bad. And, of course, you know, I was terrified again. The water, the coldness. And I see what a sacrifice it was for us as Coast Guardsmen. Mm-hmm. So I got to see the air side, and I got to see the boat side, and I got to see the admin side. And I tell you, because we had a helicopter attached to the ship, mm-hmm. it was always interesting to interact with the air crew. But you know, we had the new 65s on there. Sure, we didn't have the 52s, and I did fly in there. Thank you very much. It was down in we were in Mexico, and I got to go out on the Hilo.
That's a cool.
So it was. I couldn't believe it. I said, this thing has no room in it.
Yes.
The 52s were, oh man, they had so much room. But being on that, I said, wow. Yeah. I said, I joined a great service. And I thank God for the sacrifice that you guys made. I mean, the entire military is really a unique and special force that we have. And anybody that's been in the military knows that there is a huge sacrifice. But the Coast Guard, I think, gets a bad rap. But when the time comes and when there's natural disasters and we have to go out when the flooding and all of that, it makes me so proud to know that I have seen all of that personally in action. And it makes me, I feel some kind of way sometimes when I see that, because it really, I just can't even put it into words. I know what the sacrifice is, and I know that we're out there and we're doing the best that we can and we're doing our jobs, and people really don't realize what that sacrifice is. The ones that haven't been there, my heart aches. I'm like, wow, if I was younger and I knew better, I would have done the same thing, but I would have probably been in aviation. I probably would have wanted to do that. Hmm. Yeah, I might not want to be a little pencil pusher, as you would call it.
Hey, listen.
A little desk jockey.
Yeah, you were more than that, sister. You know.
Thank you, John. But I do. I love the personalities of all the people. And my thing was, I might not remember your name, but I knew where you were from. Mm. If you were, what state you were from. And that's how I got to know everybody. Mm. Yeah, but I really, my heart just aches sometimes to know that the sacrifice that the military men and women make to make this great country what it is.
It might be. It could be.
Hey, John, what's up, buddy?
Listen, my brother from another mother. So good to hear your voice.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Hey, man, I bet it's been 40.
It probably has. I left Chicago in May of 84.
Yeah.
So that'd be 36 years.
36. And
I
was out in, I got out of the guard in July right after you left. So it's been a long haul, man.
Oh, let me tell you, I was impressed by all you've done.
I just took it as it came, Danny. I didn't plan any of it, brother. I'm here to tell you, I ain't that smart.
Yeah, I understand, but that's pretty impressive. I'm proud of you.
Well, thanks. Thanks, man. I try to make the most of what I was given. It doesn't always work out, but, you know, you got to put your back into it and do what you can where you are, and that's all I do. And then I thought, man, I got this radio thing I've been doing for a long time, and the podcast gets a lot of listens, and I want to do something about the 230th of Coast Guard, but, you know, really it's Chicago. And everybody in Chicago, for the most part, had come from somewhere else and had other experiences or went somewhere else. And I think it just gives a real good cross-section of how things were. And I just got a phone with Mike Hicks. He's like the acting chief of everything in Cordova, Alaska, except for being the mayor.
Is that right?
Yeah.
He's up in Alaska.
Yep.
But you know what? I knew a couple of guys, especially when I first come out of boot camp and I was on a 378 out of Seattle, the Boutwell. And we made two trips up to Alaska, and I always thought after years later that how great it was up there. And, you know, I was just an 18-year-old kid, and I really didn't realize it, you know, at the time. But it really was great up there back then, even. And it was a lot more isolated back then. Like when we was at sea up there, we got to do that ham radio connection to make a phone call, you know. You'd have to get a hold of a ham radio operator, and he'd dial the phone for you, collect, of course. And he'd hold the phone up to the ham radio mic, and they always got me because my mom could never learn to say over. Yeah, she'd never get the over part. And you're probably paying about $2 a minute.
Oh, sure, sure.
But, yeah. But I knew a few guys that even said, you know, they were, you know, a lot older than me, you know, third-class petty officers and chiefs. And, hell, I was just a seaman. And, you know, I'm going to move back up here, you know, when I retire. So, yeah, I've seen that before. Well, yeah. You know, we used to have a guy. There used to be a guy on the ship. He was a machinist mate. I can't remember his name. But he was from Anchorage.
Mm.
And he was always touting. You know, everybody grilling about the weather and this and that. And,
yeah.
You know, he'd tell him, you know, he loves it and he's going home. But, and you know what? I was, man, I'm sad to hear the guys we lost from Chicago.
I know.
I mean, I couldn't believe Commander Leland.
Yeah.
You know, that one made me think a little bit. And I even did a little research online about it. And, Keith Roth.
Yep.
You know, I never heard any details about what happened, his situation, but,
yep.
You know, I mean, well, maybe I'm thinking somebody else.
So just a little while ago, George Ferguson, maybe you're thinking of Fergie or no?
Yeah, I knew about George. Oh, you know who I'm thinking of? We used to call him Armadillo.
Lonnie Shear.
Yeah. What about him?
I don't know, but he comes up in every conversation I've had with everybody.
He was a guy, let me tell you. He was really something.
Go ahead.
Wide variety of people at that air station when we were there, you know. And just a great mix of guys from all over the place. That's what I remember about it. And of course, Brenda.
So I know you've asked everybody how they came to the Guard. How did you get in the Coast Guard, Danny?
Oh, you know, it actually started with the little high school I went to. And, you know, they have career day. And there was a recruiter come in. And, you know, I thought I was a hot basketball player and I wouldn't have to worry about anything. I'd get something somewhere. But it didn't work out like that. I wasn't tall enough, I guess. But I decided, you know what, my dad was in the military, and my older brother served in Nam when I was in high school. And so I decided I was going to go into the military and you know, take advantage of things that offers. So that's how it got started. And I talked to, I figured the Coast Guard, it was a military service that was basically stayed at home. I know they didn't, but, you know, they were the ones at home taking care of everything at home. And I told people many times since I've gotten out, and And I have a nephew right now that's in high school ROTC. His older brother graduated high school 2 years ago, and he's a Navy submariner now.
Wow.
He's on the USS North Carolina, and his little brother following his route, it looks like. So I was just talking to him a couple of months ago. Him and my brother were down here. And telling him about the Coast Guard. And I told him, listen, think about it like this. In the Coast Guard, we go out, we train every day.
Mm-hmm.
For, you know, like we used to go out in helicopters and train and yep. boats and train. And that's not to fight a war. It's to save the people you live with. The people, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
We do our job right here, and the public benefits from us. And there was nothing I was more prouder of when I was at Chicago than being in charge of giving the tours.
Yep.
Because, you know, I was so proud of that place and what we did that, you know, it was just an honor to me to be able to bring in civilians and expose them to that. Because they had no idea what we do.
Right.
Other than the life-saving part. But you start showing them everything that we do. And we did a lot back then. And that Coast Guard still does a lot more than just the military part of it.
Right, right.
I don't have to tell you that.
How did you go from being on board ship, though, to ending up at Seagas? What was the route to the aviation end of it?
Well, after boot camp, that was right when I got stationed on board the Cutter. And I was there for a year and a half, and I struck yeoman. So then I finally got yeoman school at Petaluma. So when I left the Boutwell and went to Petaluma and took yeoman's training, and then after that, I was stationed at the Marine Safety Office in Peoria, Illinois. I was there for about, of course, it's not there anymore, but I was there about a year and a half, and they were closing it. It was a detachment office. We were a detachment from the St. Louis office on the Illinois River. And they were closing it down like they were, you know, closing a lot of the little detachment offices. And the spot opened up in Chicago, and it was re-enlistment time, actually.
Hmm.
And I told my guy in headquarters that if I can go to Chicago, I'll re-enlist. And that's exactly what happened.
Wow.
'Cause I wanted to stay around my parents, and
mm-hmm.
you know, they were getting pretty old, and I got to Chicago. It was only supposed to be a 2-year billet, and after 2 years, I just kind of shut my mouth and never said nothing, and it egged on and egged on until it got to a point where it wasn't feasible for the Coast Guard to send me anywhere because I already indicated I was getting out.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's basically what happened, and then I transferred in there as a YN-3, and I made YN-2 while I was there, and then I was approved for YN-1. The only problem was I didn't have enough time left in service.
Yeah, yeah.
They wanted me to extend my enlistment for a year and a half, and I decided not to do it.
Yeah.
But man, Chicago was the greatest place, and I was so lucky to. I spent almost exactly 4 years there to the day.
Huh.
Yeah. It was great.
I was telling people, you know, there's everybody on this show is special to me, and for different reasons, you know. I talked with Cap Drombeck, and you know, I kind of busted him a little bit saying the first directive I remember he gave, you know, so you were there when Captain Allison was there, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then
yeah.
then we had the change of command, and then Cap Drombeck came in, and there couldn't be two different guys than those two guys.
And, that's true.
And Captain Drombeck's first directive was, every Friday in the summer, we're having a beer bash at 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I like this guy. But
and
go ahead.
That was the greatest part of that, you know, the way we would do things. Remember when we'd take off for the Cubs games?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was just great the way there was such camaraderie there.
Yeah.
It was just an unbelievable place. And again, you don't realize them kind of things till they're gone.
Yep.
And you start thinking, man, that was And, you know, that was a beautiful environment to be in there at that time. And just the long-lasting friendships, too, you know.
Truly amazing. Truly amazing.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You don't probably remember. You know, hang on. I mean, you, go ahead.
You remember, you mentioned Captain Jerombeck. I'll tell you one of the things I remember about him that always stuck with me. He first got there, and he was driving into work one day, and he got a ticket for going through a speed zone, a school zone.
Yeah.
And he come in, and he was talking to, I want to think it was either Lieutenant Gallagher or his XO, Redinger.
Yep.
And he was just complaining. There were no kids. If there's no kids, does that mean you still got to go 20? He was mad because there were no kids. I wonder if he remembers that.
When he hears this show, he will.
That was so funny.
Such a cast of characters. You know, it was really. I've said this many times through the show. It felt like Animal House in some respects. Every day, you never knew what was going to happen. But when it needed to take place, when the SAR bell went off or something needed to be taken care of, all that got put aside. And you wouldn't find a more dedicated, hardworking, disciplined crew anywhere.
Yeah, we were all business. And, you know, even as a yeoman there, I got out and, you know, I was pushing out helos.
That's it.
You know, pulling in helos and, you know, it was really something to be there. You wanted to chip in and, you know, we had good leaders too.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
I mean, when I was there, like I say, I was just a third class petty officer. So, you know, we had good leaders and, that's what I remember about the place. And it was just a great place.
Oh, I'm telling you, you're 100% right. Part of the reason I'm doing this is, you know, we're all getting up there and we're, you know, we've lost friends and crewmates and shipmates and nothing's forever. And I wanted to, you know, talk to everybody and get their feelings on things. And everybody just lit up like a Christmas tree. By the way, the Christmas parties were pretty good. We had great Christmas parties. I remember that pretty well.
Oh, yeah.
But the first day that I showed up for duty was in June of 1980. I just got out of Alameda like 2 weeks before. I had my 2 weeks off, went home, did whatever, and I was able to have first choice out of boot camp where I wanted to go. And I wasn't adverse to getting on a cutter, but there was an opportunity to be around helicopters. I was all about it. So I took that first shot, you know, at Glenview at the Naval Air Base, and I showed up. I parked at the front gate. I don't even remember why, but I didn't get a parking sticker to get on the base, so I left my car.
Yeah.
I left my car at the front gate and walked a mile and a half back to the Coast Guard hangar with my sea bag. I'm wearing my dress blues. I'm showing up, you know, for my duty. I'm ready to go and get all this done. And it was, I think it might have been a Friday or Saturday. I don't recall. At 7 o'clock, I'm banging on the hangar door, banging away, sea bag over my shoulder. I got my dress blues on. I'm ready to go to work and first day ever as a Coastie. And you answered the door about 7:15 in the morning, half asleep. Got your basketball shorts on and a cutoff sleeve T-shirt, and you open the door like, "What the hell are you doing here so early, rookie?" And I'm like, "I'm here for duty, sir." You're like, "Don't call me sir. I know my parents. Knock it off." You know. And
And we were probably all still, if it was only 7, we were probably still sleeping.
Probably. That was great. That was my introduction.
You remember how they used to give the duty officer that his own little bedroom?
That little room? Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Then they shoved us all in that bunk room.
I know. That was tight quarters, man. It was so great. And, you know, that just kicked off my time there, which was great. And everything from jocks and socks to the off-duty stuff. But again, every day I went in there, I felt so proud to be working with everybody that was there from morning muster and watching everybody stand there with a coffee mug and fake names being said. Is Romberg Rabbit here today? Is Alligator here today? All that shit. It was just a great time. And like you said, now you look back on it, that's all gone. That whole place is gone. There's no remnants of it at all. But the memories are there.
Yeah, I was looking at it on Google Earth, and it was hard to even pinpoint where it was.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't for the golf course.
That's right.
You'd never even know that whole thing was there, but yeah, it's kind of sad when I heard that place, you know, a lot of those old bases are gone.
Sure. We were talking before with a few of the folks about how, you know, we'd have the duty, like you said, and there were many times, probably six times, four times, somewhere in there, that the budget was going on, and we were wondering if we were going to have paychecks the next day.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Remember that? And
yeah.
You'd always be running down to the op center and pulling off a teletype going, okay, boys, we get to go to work tomorrow, because at the last minute, they would keep coast. There was bases closed for, you know, for budget, and Coast Guard Air Station Chicago was open another year, so we were good to go. But those were different times.
Yeah. Well, you know, they still fight that today, actually, you know. We just had that situation not too long ago when they had the government shut down.
And,
you know, the Coast Guard wasn't getting paid. And,
boy, that really, you know, Danny, that really burned my backside. I thought, putting all the politics aside, it's like you said, you know, we're here doing what we're doing right here on these shores, and when you're not taking care of those people, that says a lot about what's not working somewhere. And when you're holding garage sales to pay the petty officers, you know, rent, that ain't good.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of those situations in government and politics that when a simple man looks at it in a simple manner, you go, listen, this is not that difficult. You know, we tend to make things a lot more difficult than they are.
We may not like it. This is what's happening on our watch. We got to deal with it. We could do better. And I think that starts, like we learned when we took the oath, that it starts with each of us first and then looking out for the people in our immediate surroundings, and then you go from there. And if you can do that, at least you can handle what's in front of you. The rest of the stuff, if you can't control it, you just got to respond, you know, the best way you can. And that, to me, was always the thing about being in the Coast Guard. It's a response-oriented military service, because you prepare, train, prepare. And when that bell went off or there was a training flight scheduled, it went like clockwork, no matter what. And the cool thing, I always say this to people, when we were all together in Chicago, Danny, I didn't know if anybody was a Republican, a Democrat, or independent, or a Catholic, or Protestant.
That's right.
Never knew. We never. None of that ever happened.
Didn't matter. And you know what? Today, with me, it still doesn't matter.
Is there any big aha or takeaway from the time you spent in the Coast Guard? Everybody's had something. They're like, you know, I remember this, remember that. But was there one big takeaway? I think you said some of them in the conversation, like the camaraderie, teamwork, things like that. Things that played out in your life when you left. Anything come to mind?
Well, those are the biggest things I took, is the dedication you put to whatever you're doing. You know, I carried that through the camaraderie. I always look for the camaraderie amongst people that I'm closely associated with and try to nurture that. And just being proud of the time that I spent in the Coast Guard, how good it makes me feel to talk to somebody that's never experienced it and tell them about it and be able to tell them about all these things and the people and, you know, the camaraderie and the dedication and the serving of your country.
Listen, you be safe. I love you, and I'll talk to you.
Thank you, sir. Me too.